Okay, so we welcome to the program. We've got Jonathan Dorr with us. So thank you, Jonathan Dorr, for your time.
Jamie, good to be here. A guy from the US Marines said to me many years ago that any day above ground is a good day. So we're both breathing. It's good to be here.
Indeed, indeed. And it's a fine day where I am, mate. We're calling over the phone, so it's a, as I say, pre-recorded interview. I take it you're in Canberra?
I'm in the national capital. I don't know when this will go to air, but it's Anzac Day here today, and very special day here. The weather is absolutely stunning, and I've been out on the bike this morning, you know, after the dawn service and stuff. So it's a beautiful day here, and you know, really important day for so many people, and sure. Just to remember the sacrifice of so many good people.
No doubt, the town's in a buzz up there too.
I mean, it's a great day. It's you know, the dawn service here has grown massively over recent years, and it's a fantastic day. So we, you know, people tend to get out there in the morning, nice and early, and then it's a really laid back day. And you know, I can't speak to the truth of whether large numbers of public servants then disappear for the next 3 to 4 days, but who knows, mate? But no, good day in the national capital.
Yeah, great. I suppose we'll get into it. I just want to. For those who don't know you, a little bit about yourself, where you've come from. I know you've got a lot of different projects on at the moment. No doubt a lot of people have heard of you, but there might be some out there who haven't. So tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Mate, it's a great question. I was in a corporate box the other day watching the Raiders play, and you know, I keep getting the question from people in the box, you know, what do you do? And I think my best answer historically has been, I tell them I'm in the pie industry, I'm in the baking industry, because I've always got fingers in lots of pies, you know. Mate, look, historically, my background, I began in teaching quite a few years ago now, and then I churned out a couple of master's degrees really fast, one in leadership and management, and then the second one I ended up at the Pontifical Institute, the John Paul II Institute, which had a massive impact. And look, in teaching, I absolutely loved the kids. I found the system pretty challenging, and I think I probably had an entrepreneurial kind of bent pretty early on. And so I got out of teaching, and Karen, my wife, and I set up a business. We're getting close to 10 years now. The first main business was Choices Media, which is a big provider to the sort of independent Catholic school system in the country. So about 80 to 90% of schools use our stuff. And linked to the media business was also a speaking business. So I would do a huge amount of travel and speaking on relationships and Catholic identity and staff formation. And so about 300,000 people in audiences around the world so far. And then
great. Just on that for a second, John. You mentioned... the couple of challenges you found in education when you were a teacher. Do you see this then as some sort of corrective to that?
Look, I'd say that it's something we're really passionate about. I think I always like John Paul II's term of people of goodwill. You know, there's definitely some people in any organisation, in any school, who are working against the real charism of Catholic education. There's not many of them. What we have is a lot of really committed people, fantastic people, and we've got a lot of people who are very much people of goodwill who just haven't had the kind of theological formation or support that they need to really understand what it is that Catholic education is all about. So one of our other websites, the Being Catholic site, is really about supporting them and just churning out truckloads of great content to help teachers and principals and Catholic Education Office leaders to become really, I guess, enthusiastic and excited about what they're trying to do in there.
Sure. I did cut you off too, Jonathan, so feel free to continue after that. You were talking, your next one was Being Catholic, was it? Or?
Yeah, beingcatholic.com.au was really built to serve educators and teachers, and things have grown from there. So I've got a whole range of sites. If I'm not doing the Choices Media stuff, I mean, Choices Media now rolls out one or two big programs a year. So we've just launched a massive new program called The Men We Need, which is a program for boys in schools, which covers pornography addiction, role models, relationships with women, all that stuff. So I oversee the big projects, and I've got my own private site where I do a lot of personal development, motivation stuff, which is a real passion too. So, you know, writing books, speaking selectively, trying to raise a tribe of small children. So, look, busy, but I guess at the moment, loving the growth of kind of social media and what that means for Catholic people and communicating, you know, different in different areas. So really trying to stay on the cutting edge of communicating with people. And look, at the end of the day, Jamie, you know, a mentor said to me recently, he was like, well, what is it that you really do? What is your core thing? And knowing that I'd be speaking to you today, I was like, you know, well, really, at the end of the day, what I love more than anything else is helping people have a better life, you know. So I'm, whether it's just encouraging, motivating people, giving them great stuff, and I think huge numbers of us live so far below what's possible in our lives. So I'm just the guy that kind of tries to get in there and maybe show people what's possible.
Yeah, no, I certainly understand. I think you've made an impact in my life too, Jonathan, no doubt. When I came across your stuff early last year, and I thought this is something I've got to, you know, you sort of run with as well. You sort of have a lot of good stuff out there. And thanks for that introduction too, Jonathan. There's a whole bunch there we'll hit through the course of the show. You're listening to Catholic Connection with Jamie Floyd. This is a pre-recorded interview with Jonathan Doyle, so we won't be taking any calls today. We thank Jonathan for a time, and we'll just go to a quick tune. Okay, so welcome back. We've got Jonathan Doyle with us. This is Catholic Connection. We'll continue our interview. Jonathan, so you do a lot of work to motivate others. What do you find is it motivates you? I mean, what's your driving force?
Well, I love that you sent some questions through to me on email, and I think, you know, I'm the guy always asking everybody else those questions. And, you know, look, I think what motivates me is probably like a lot of listeners is I had a somewhat challenging childhood. I think there was definitely some challenges there, and, you know, I'll keep that pretty broad, and people have had it better and people have had it worse. And people like me who experienced some of the things that I did, you kind of face a choice about the life that you could have. And I sometimes say to people that I guess I could have stuck a needle in my arm or started building businesses and trying to change the world, and I took option B. Mm-hmm. So, look, I married well. I was lucky through my Catholic faith to kind of meet somebody really fantastic, and we did a lot of work building a foundation of relationship before we were married. And so I, like a lot of, you know, men who've had some success in life, we're supported, and you know, by great spouses, and Karen definitely has been a huge part of the journey. So what motivates me is I think I'm just interested in what's possible. And Jamie, honestly, I think people see me on stage or they hear stuff and they think I've got it figured out, and I can honestly say I spend every day just chiseling away, just constantly working on me and trying to grow and become a better human being. And so my motivation is trying to serve people, trying to grow, constantly trying to be a better husband and father, and that just takes a lot of work and mindfulness. You know, I just want to get to the end of the journey and know that I didn't miss out on anything, and that I didn't, you know, waste any opportunities to reach other people and to grow.
You've mentioned mindfulness, and I know you've certainly said a podcast or two about that as well. Just I suppose speak a little about that if you could.
Yeah, look, I think mindfulness is crucial, and you know, that's something that probably people more associate with Eastern mysticism, and it's definitely something that the Eastern faiths really focus on. But I think my take would be that currently in the cultures that we have, we live in very fragmented cultures. Technology has allowed a reach into people's lives and a kind of breakdown of some of the kind of social interactions and the ways that we've lived for really thousands of years. Now, there's a lot of positives. I'm not saying we go and live in caves, but you know, a lot of time we actually have to be very deliberate about what's important. And when I do motivational stuff, that's kind of the first step is just actually going, well, what do I really want? Why am I here? And being mindful and deliberate about that stuff. So that's the first thing. And, you know, in the postgraduate work I did, we do know that the technology is affecting brain structure. So our neural pathways are actually, well, definitely being affected by our use of technology in different ways. And there's a great book by Nicholas Carr, you know, on the internet and talking about what that does. But so what I have to do is a lot of the time I have to really be specifically say to myself, be mindful, tune in, concentrate, be present. My little boy, I put a blog post on our Choices site the other day about my, you know, I was here with my little boy who's into dinosaurs. and he was chiseling this dinosaur out of a little sort of rock kind of plaster case, and it's like training them to be little archaeologists. And, you know, there I am, and I'm, you know, I could do 400 social media things, I could be, you know, sending emails, doing all this stuff, but I force myself to concentrate, be present, be here right now, and tune into this moment. So, you know, summary, I think I'm definitely not a huge fan of some of Bill Clinton's adventures, but people would often say that when he was talking to you, you felt like the most important person in the world. And when I meet people, I try and really bore in and really concentrate, no matter who they are, and be mindful. So I just think, in general, it's important for people just to kind of go, what do I want? Why am I here? What's important? And be present to reality, to their relationships, their family. Mm. We're all plugged in.
It sounds familiar to a story that you mentioned John Paul II earlier at the Institute, but there's a story similar to John Paul II with one of the guards that he has a talk to. And I can't think of his name or whatnot, just a story I remember hearing last year. And the guards ended up writing a book about it and the impact that he had in his life. And he's gone off and done similar sort of thing as I think was what you've done, but it was after a conversation with John Paul II. And he says there wasn't a man in the world who talked to him and stopped. He felt as though he had the full attention there and then. But it was sort of just a couple of minutes between an appearance somewhere. He was making something at the Vatican, some sort of coming out of the balcony or something like that. But he took a couple of minutes to stop and focus directly on this guard who was there. So
yeah, and I think we're seeing that too. We're seeing a bit of that with Pope Francis too. I think, you know, just the sort of mindfulness indeed that he has. And I've put a blog post on the Being Catholic site a few weeks back where I wrote about you meeting a guy at a car wash. And I think if people look at that Being Catholic site, the post is called "Did Jesus Steal My Wallet?" And I was at a car wash, and I lost my wallet. I had the kids with me, and you know, I met this the bloke running the car wash looked like he'd just come straight out of, you know, maximum security. And all this sort of judgment that went through my head, and, you know, when I couldn't find the wallet, turns out I'd lost it at a hardware store. But, you know, when I got out of the car at the car wash, I'd said g'day to him and just was very friendly. And later in the day when I rang back to see how he, you know, just touch base that he found it, he said, "Oh, yeah, mate, I remember who you are." And I said, "Oh, cool." He goes, "You're the only person that's ever said hello to me." And I was just blown away. I was like, "Are you serious?" Like, people look at him, and I judged him too, but I made an effort to just actually connect. So mindfulness, I guess, is just about, you know, I mean, it's a very Catholic thing, you know, the value and dignity of the human person. Every person you encounter, you know, Christ went to Calvary for.
Yeah.
People you can't stand. Like, and I have to remind myself of that all the time. And that's what I love about a Catholic vision of culture, is that people matter, you know, and they matter because of, you know, what Christ did.
Indeed. Now, I remember reading that post, actually, so, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned it. It's that having an impact in life. I suppose, speak a little bit about the talking at schools you do. I know it's probably where a lot of people would know, certainly in Catholic education, speaking to both the students but also the teachers as well. So if you could talk a little bit about that impacting their lives.
Yeah, look, that's where it all started. Is Karen and I built the business where we would go and run seminars for students based out of our kind of work. Look, years ago, we were working in a boarding school, a co-ed boarding school, and we were just after we married, and the stuff that we were seeing was amazing, you know, like sexually transmitted infections, a huge amount of emotional, you know, trauma to kids, and kids making terrible decisions, and a lot of the staff didn't want to know about it. And we kind of got pigeonholed as fundamentalists because we were like trying to put this on the radar and say, look, the kids are suffering out there. They're making some abysmal choices. And so we started there, and we sort of built a seminar program. Then we started the business, and we built from scratch, and we just hustled for years and really grew that business where we'd speak to, you know, around about 30 to 40,000 students per year in full-day seminars. And I sort of stepped out of that role, had some staff working for me as we had more kids. Like, basically, we got to the point where I'd, you know, built that business and had a young family of my own. So that transitioned, and now That's been done by a great couple, David and Katie, who do a fantastic job. So, look, just memorable, you know, like, you know, 7,000 followers on Facebook from the seminars that we did, just incredible feedback from kids over the years. And that led into sort of staff professional development and parent sessions and conferences where we'd, you know, just try and step Catholic staff through, you know, issues around relationship, sexuality, masculinity, John Paul II stuff on the feminine genius. And more recently, I did stuff on really Catholic identity. Like, the ultimate question is, you know, what happens in a Catholic school when the majority of the staff are not really, you know, really connected to their faith? In what way does that school become different to any other option? So that's a real passion, and, you know, building the Being Catholic site now. And I think the next step for us, Jamie, is we're going to start delivering, you know, either daily or weekly video to subscribing schools for teachers. So teachers every day or every week will get some really high quality video input on helping form them. You know, the Catholic faith, I often say, is that it's, you know, we've got the greatest product in the world with the worst marketing department. So indeed, you know. It was the study that allowed me to kind of really encounter that, and most of our staff, who are great people, don't get to do that level of study, so they're starving out there. And you know, Catholic education is about the person of Jesus and really bringing that person to young people, you know, through things like truth, beauty, and goodness, like, and science and stuff, and truth and reason are all part of that. But we're trying to give staff that infusion of energy, that passion. I often say at the end of seminars to staff, I say, you know, if you set yourself on fire, everybody will come and watch you burn. So it's about, and often when people, you know, they walk out of seminars and like, I never knew that. You know, I had dinner with one of the top Catholic education people in New Zealand a few years ago, and he was doing a second PhD around this sort of stuff. And he said, look, the best evidence we have is that our teachers, less than 8% of our teachers have formal theological qualifications. So we have Catholic schools. So basically, you know, and cut me off because I'll go for hours, but for most of history, our schools were staffed by religious.
Yes.
We come to the 1950s and 60s. We have a massive change and we transition to lay leadership. And there's a lot of great stuff about that and a lot of great teachers. But without that level of formation, people are getting formed from their newspapers, from the internet, and I think most people get a caricature of the Catholic Church. They get a, you know, the Catholic Church hates everybody, the Catholic Church wants everyone to go to hell, and it's just ridiculous, and no one's had the chance to really study the depth of it. So we're just trying to take the depth of that teaching, package it in really appealing ways, and serve as many people as possible with it.
You get a lot of feedback from students, you say, and no doubt from some of the teachers as well. Over the years that you've done this, have you seen an impact or a change in the schools that you've gone to? Do you feel as though that the Catholic identity within each school has improved somewhat? Perhaps over the years you might see a greater change. Have you seen anything like that?
Look, I think, you know, we a vast amount of anecdotal evidence in terms of, you know, I remember once at a school in Melbourne, it was our second year there, and Karen and I were there, and there's this bang on the window outside. And, you know, there's this girl and she's just yelling through the window. She goes, I know you. You changed my life. And it's the coolest thing. So we've had truckloads of that stuff. A lot of times in seminars with students, fundamentally what we were doing, not specifically, was giving them permission. You know, they felt so sort of enculturated by, you know, Hollywood and media and marketing and pornography that they had to act a certain way. And all of a sudden, you got a couple up there in front of them giving really good peer-reviewed evidence and a whole bunch of great stuff and saying, look, you're very free to make a different choice, you know, and what do you feel? What do you think? What do you think will make you happy?
Yeah.
And it was like waving a magic wand. They were like, you mean we're allowed to think that? Like we can actually not have to follow the party line. So anecdotally, you know, incredible stuff over the years through, you know, through seminars and through Facebook and feedback like that. Being in the box last week for the footy, this young couple kept staring at me. And I'm thinking, like, is there a chicken wing on my face or something? And I look up and this bloke goes, you're a speaker, a motivational speaker, aren't you? And it turns out I'd been done sessions 3 or 4 years ago. And so that was nice. And I guess your question gets to the heart of, you know, really to evaluate major change, you're going to have to build a huge evaluative model and do a lot of, you know, survey work and follow-up work, and we didn't do that. I think what we were doing was going in there, providing a great one-day experience, and then trying to empower staff to follow up with that. And in terms of your question on, you know, do we see change in school culture, I'd have to say that our success is linked powerfully to what's present when we walk in the door. So if we've got principals and religious education coordinators who really know their faith and are passionate about it, you know, it's like we can hit the ball out of the park. You know, there's a lot of goodwill in the room. If that hasn't happened and none of the foundation work's there, it's a tough slog. And, you know, I think why we're going to the online model, why we're really sourcing, resourcing that being Catholic side is because you've got to walk with people long term. You know, I can do a cracking job in a one-day seminar, but what I really want to do is that plus support people long term and just keep answering questions and adding content and serving people that way.
Excellent. I suppose we have been talking a lot about the stuff you've done for education over the years, and your role in that and how that's developed. What other projects have you got in the future? Where do you hope to go to from here? You mentioned you passed over the education to another couple. What do you see down the pipeline?
One of the things we do is we produce a magazine that goes to about 40-odd thousand senior students a year, called The Road Ahead, which provides a sort of start-of-the-year full-colour magazine on a whole bunch of topics related to the stuff we do in the seminars. So that's a big project for us every year, you know, and it's growing. So it'll probably be about 50,000 students in this country next year. And we're in discussions at the moment to provide it to Catholic universities too. So that's a big project for us. It's an annual project. My personal development motivation stuff is growing really fast, so I'll be putting a lot into that. Books, writing more, and look, I want to leave the Being Catholic site alone. I keep saying to Karen, I go, it doesn't generate revenues, it doesn't do this, and I find myself back in the office just about every day playing with it, going, you know, what am I doing? And you know, Christine Kane from Hillsong once said, you know an idea is from God when you try to leave it alone, but it won't leave you alone. And, there are so many great teachers out there, and I think you can hear it in my voice, like the passion to just serve them and to introduce them to the real church. And that's what the study did. One of the things we studied in the Institute was what's called the transcendentals, which is really important for Catholics to know, which is, it goes back to Aristotle, but it was probably shaped up most effectively by Thomas Aquinas, which is the concepts of truth, beauty, and goodness are three aspects that exist inside the Godhead. And they call them transcendentals because they transcend any individual person or thing. They're just ubiquitous. And one of the gateways into reaching people is through truth, beauty, and goodness. And the theory from some of our greatest theologians like Hans-Urs von Balthasar would be that everybody has a dominant transcendental. So some people be really impacted by truth. So they get affected by Martin Luther King's life or Gandhi's life or Mandela's life. And some people are impacted by beauty, and some by goodness, which is, you know, the sort of the social justice arm of the church. So I think we've got an amazing avenue into people's lives that we're not using. And, you can cut me off if I ramble, but I was just reading First Things in the American Catholic Journal the other night, and they were doing a big thing on von Balthasar, who, if your listeners haven't heard of him, he's probably the greatest lay theologian of maybe the last 400 or 500 years. And he his take was that, you know, what we've done the last probably 50 to 100 years is we've tried to get into apologetic arguments with people. We're going to prove to you that the church is right and God exists. And that's important. It's really important. But von Balthasar would say that comes at the end. What you want to do is find a window into people's life and their experience through truth, beauty, or goodness, because that's something everybody can hang their hat on and go, yes, I know that. I've felt love. I've experienced an incredible sunset. So when I do staff PD, I often talk about C.S. Lewis's stuff on infinite desire, which, you know, and I spoke in Brisbane last week, and I quoted him where, you know, he said, if I find in myself desires that nothing in this world can satisfy, then I can only assume that I wasn't made for here. So when I'm working with staff, I'm like truth, beauty, and goodness. You know, we feel hunger, and there is a thing called food, and we can use food to meet that need. We get thirsty, we can drink water. We have these finite needs that we can fill in the moment, but our desires for truth, beauty, and goodness are beyond, you know, we can't meet them in this life, and that is telling us something. So I say to the audience of teachers, I go, look, has anybody in this room ever gone, that's too much truth, you know, I want some lies now, I've had enough truth. Nobody, you know, no one stands on a beach at sunrise and go, well, that's too much beauty, can you turn it off? I don't want to see any more beauty. So we're, you know, in the Latin, we're capax Dei, which is that which has the capacity for God. So I come, you know, to answering your question on future projects, you know, I think that's the public space, the Twitter sphere is so toxic, and people are so entrenched in their kind of, honestly, there's a lot of anti-Catholic bigotry and prejudice. Often say that anti-Catholicism is the last acceptable prejudice in this country. Like,
I think you're
right. It's the only acceptable prejudice. You can, you know, turn on the ABC any night of the week, no offense, listeners, and, you know, the Catholic Church is fair game. And people are like, well, they deserves it. And I've gone, well, come on, let's think a bit more deeply here. Yeah, so that's my probably one future project. So I'm split between the two, between my personal business in the motivation, personal development stuff, and probably, you know, we're going to keep developing this, the Being Catholic stuff.
I want to get back to you specifically in a moment, but while we're talking about truth, beauty, and goodness, which it blew me away when I heard it, and I actually use it to highlight to my two boys. That's where you see God in your life. So where the truth is, when you see beauty and where you see goodness, this is where God expresses himself most fully.
Yeah.
A distortion of that, one of the things that you've mentioned earlier was your work with particularly pornography.
Yeah.
I see that as a distortion. Talk a little bit about the project that you're doing regarding pornography. I mentioned you're on a show at one stage as well, weren't you?
I was on ABC Insight. The producer emailed me the night before it went to air because I'd been involved with them really closely, developing the content, and they were like looking at me kind of from an expert point of view to help them find more experts and stuff. And they rang me, they emailed me just before I actually went on stage in Sydney, and the email came through just before I went on. And the producer said, oh, look, we've edited out everything you said. And if you ever see the footage, you just see me on the screen looking perplexed and frustrated because I was trying to move the argument from a kind of juvenile focus on I can do whatever I want to what we know from the science. So look, the pornography stuff, I'm the most reluctant communicator on the topic. It's one of those things that is probably a God thing because it is a toxic topic. Mm-hmm. I walk off stage exhausted by it. There is no triumph in it, but it's just one of those things that as we did this work, it became more and more obvious that this was an enormous problem. So we got a whole bunch of sites like stopusingpornography.com, the new boys program at men.choices.com.au, that has a whole module, two modules out of seven for the boys are focused on that topic. So probably the most useful thing for listeners is, you know, pornography has been seen as a kind of moral issue. So is it right or wrong, good or bad? What about free speech? Surely what people do in private is their own business. What I've tried to do is, God, it's all that. It's a, you know, especially from a Catholic perspective, it's a fundamentally moral question. But what I've been trying to do is help people understand that we now have a vast and growing range of scientific data, and a lot of it's peer-reviewed. So we know that what it's doing is, again, like technology itself, is changing brain structure in particular ways. So the way to conceptualize it is, from a male perspective, for most of history, the average male experienced sexual arousal relatively intermittently. So depending on, you know, their living arrangement or whatever, they might be sexually active frequently, but, you know, not all the time. So what the internet's done is allow men to access high levels of sexual arousal, often daily, often for hours at a time. Now, while that's happening, you know, the brain is dumping huge amounts of neurochemicals into the brainstem. So norepinephrine, epinephrine, cortisol, adrenaline, and specifically dopamine, which is the brain's pleasure chemical. Now, everybody goes, well, what's the problem? Well, it's happening at massively elevated levels. And people think, well, how massive? Well, British Parliamentary Inquiry, 4 out of 5 16-year-olds access weekly. London's Portman Clinic, you know, 30% of juvenile admissions pornography addiction is a significant part of it. Now, the thing about dopamine is once your brain starts to secrete way too much dopamine, your brain compensates by creating secreting another neurochemical called delta-phos-B. Problem with delta-phos-B is it eats brain matter. And the biggest study we've seen in the world, out of China on internet addiction, showed up to a 20% reduction in frontal lobe gray matter for internet and pornography addicts. Now, so one of the things pornography addiction will do is it overrides what's called our satiety mechanism. So if you're hungry, you eat a cheeseburger, your brain goes, okay, that's a cheeseburger. You have 3 cheeseburgers, your brain says, well, that's probably enough. You have 5, you have 10, your brain starts to go nuts and go, I'm dying here, stop it. The thing about pornography is our brains are wired for novelty. So we can go into an aroused state, but then click, 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 and we keep hitting new content, and it overrides the brain's satiety mechanism. Hence, people can stay in aroused states for often hours at a time. What we'll see for boys is stuff like the impact on brain chemistry is it'll do things like lack of impulse control. So in the prefrontal cortex where we have impulse control, our higher order thinking, we know that that's starting to get impacted by pornography addiction. So that's the neuroscience. That's part of the neuroscience. Then you've got the effect on marriages, relationships. So it's basically the visual nature of male sexual arousal has just been hijacked by massive technological change. So the current generation is just going to have some pretty spectacular problems with intimacy. So, on my jonathandoyle.co site, I did a talk on it last week, and I put the videos up there from the professors from UCLA, which actually go through the neuroscience. So I'm not a crusader. I'm not here to tell people that they're wrong. I'm just here to tell people that this is a perfect storm, and women need to be very switched onto it, and men do too.
You mentioned earlier that it makes you nervous doing this. It's not something you're necessarily comfortable about doing, but that it's more of a God's will, I suppose, in this. What role does your faith and, I suppose, your relationship with God have with not only this activity, but I suppose in a broader sense with doing all of these? Do you think God is calling you to this mission?
I'd say I hope not. I'm an absolute realist, and anybody that sort of, I get really concerned when I meet people like, God's told me to do this, and I'm going to do this. And I'm like, oh, maybe you're right, but I've never been that kind of person. I'm like, I'm a bit like Jonah. I'm like, I've got to go to London to speak for the Diocese of Westminster, and I'm like, God's kind of dragging me the other side of the planet, and I'm like, I'm just there going, this is a toxic topic. I wish it wasn't a big one, but for some reason, I've done a lot of research and reading, and I'm speaking at the World Congress of Families in a couple of weeks, and is God calling me to it? I think a nun once said, God comes to you disguised as your life. Years ago, I was at a conference in Singapore, and I met a guy who was one of the top guys for DHL in Asia for the courier company, and his job was to go through and sort of cut all the costs out of the business. And I remember he looked at me and he goes, I don't get to play on the positive side of the ledger that much, like spending money. And I'm like, this topic's like that. It's like it's a topic that, you walk into a room, and if you've got a room of men there, a lot of them are really challenged and uncomfortable. I've done student seminars where male staff have had a big problem with it and have been really, kind of not offended, but you can tell that they just don't want to know about it, and they don't want you to talk about it either. So my job's to get up every day and to pray and to live my faith as effectively as possible. And the biggest thing that's helped me in the last few months is I've made a decision to go to weekly confession. And I just encourage any Catholic listeners, like, it's the most massively underused sacrament. You don't have to go weekly, but it's just a part of the week where it's quiet and I can duck in there and get some time for prayer. And, I just try and give God the opportunity to work with me however he wants. My job is to provide for Karen and the kids and be a great husband and father. And, I have enough trouble doing that and doing that well, that I'm not a crusader to kind of change the world. So, and I think, look, maybe that's what God wants. And Catholic history seems to be a bit like that, like that that there's these kind of quiet achievers that that reluctantly kind of, you know, did things, and it has a big effect. So at the end of the day, pornography just harms people, you know, and the catechism, the church's own quote in the catechism, you know, talks about that. You know, it says it does grave injury to everybody, the actors, the viewers, the sellers. And this one's a killer. It really damages our young men. It gives them toxic belief systems. You know, I worked with Professor Marianne Layden from the University of Massachusetts, who's a world expert on it, and she's like, pornography is a curriculum. It's a training mechanism. Like, young men are coming into the peak of their sexuality, spending often hours a day seeing bizarre, violent sexual practices, and we want to pretend that that's not a formation system for them. So, and look, from a Catholic point of view, you know, no fire and brimstone, but the concept of mortal sin is interesting, because mortal sin, the great definition of it is that it kills the life of grace in the soul. So it's not about God wants to send anybody anywhere. It's more about God wants to love and empower and work with us, but mortal sin kills off that grace that he wants to give us, and it deadens it. So when you get a generation that's formed, many young men formed by pornography, reaching them with the gospel, reaching them with, you know, they're already so compromised and damaged that it can be hard for them to hear. And if you're confronted with a message, like if you're using pornography and somebody comes in a room and starts talking about it, however gently, which is what I try to do, it's hard work, because if you don't want to hear that, you're going to push back. And so that's a tough, as a speaker, it's a tough job.
It's one of those sticking points. And there's certainly a number of others as well on many other mortal sins. I won't go into it. I had a similar discussion on gay marriage as well, which is, of course, very politicised at the moment. So it's anything sexual these days, isn't it? But look, we'll take a break, Jonathan, if that's all right. You're listening to Catholic Connection on 97.7 KC Radio. We'll come back after the break and we'll finish on a lighter note, Jonathan. So
good stuff.
And now you're listening to Jonathan Doyle on 97.7 KC Radio. Thank you for your time, Jonathan. We'll wrap it up with two final questions, I suppose. What tips would you have for anybody else trying to follow your steps in living out, I suppose, God's mission for the world? Perhaps not our own personal ones, but there's certainly some challenges there that you're laying out to us. What would you do for those who want to do the same sort of thing, not necessarily struggling with one of those things you're
sure,
fixing?
Sure, yeah. Look, Chesterton, who's not G.K. Chesterton, somebody I haven't read widely, but like a lot of people, you just keep hearing his amazing quotes. And I think, to paraphrase one of his famous ones, he said, you know, we call it the Catholic life. I think he said the Christian life. But, you know, the Catholic life hasn't been tried and found wanting. It's been found difficult and left untried. Let's be honest. Living an authentic Catholic sacramental life in this culture is hard work, like, in some ways. Like, you've actually got to step up. And I can do now is speak to men and say, you know, growing up in my house, my father had this plaque and this sort of scriptural statement that sort of formed a lot of our childhood. And it was the famous quote where, Moses says to, Joshua, sorry, says to the Israelites, basically, he's forcing him to make a choice. He said, you know, at the end of the day, if you want to go and serve the gods that your forefathers served beyond the river, well, you go and do that. But he said, it's a very powerful line. He said, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And even now, it almost moves me to tears, because my father's died, but it's just so tied into my memories of him. I just, you know, want my kids to grow up with the faith, and you've got to be in the game. Like, the sacramental life, it's like we've got these sacraments and people think, well, you know, I'll just dabble with them once in a while if I have to. Like, you know, going to confession with a great priest, you know, you find that what happens is you wipe out the big sins pretty fast, and then this whole layer of small things like lack of charity, you know, not loving your husband or your wife very well, you know, being short-tempered with your kids. And you know, if you step up to the sacraments, you put your hand up and go, yeah, I'm going to go there, I'm going to put myself in that place, then, you know, you're giving God a chance to work. And, you know, and if you're going to confession, then the grace from the Eucharist is really powerful. You know, people meet me, like, I'm kind of like a sort of, you know, if you met me somewhere, you'd think, I don't know, like, I live a very modern life. You know, we have a beautiful home. I play golf, you know, 5 days a week. But behind all that is this deep desire for contemplation and silence and prayer. Do I always get it? No, I don't. But I, you know, Karen and I try and, you know, read the readings for the day. Look, to answer your question, Jamie, people have to make a decision. Like, if you want to grow closer to God, you know, you're going to have to step up. And, you know, your concept about the mission, their mission in the world, some of the best Catholic thinkers in the world at the moment, if you look at George Weigel's latest book, you know, re-evangelizing or, you know, mm-hmm. Catholic culture, there's a lot of books coming out about Catholic culture. Like, the way to impact the society is to re-energize a Catholic culture. And that is some of the best bishops, lay people in the world writing, us all starting to write about that. We need to get back to sacraments. We need to become evangelists. We need to live as best we can by the grace of God. We've got to live holiness in our own lives and leave the rest up to God. You know, just Mother Teresa, you know, act, you know, pray as if everything depends on God and act as if everything depends on you. So I've just got to be a committed Catholic. I've got to love the church. I've got to love God through the church. And just keep turning up. It's not pretty. You just got to keep turning up. You know, I did a podcast years ago called Winning Ugly. I always liked how the Melbourne Storm used to just win ugly. You know, they could just grind out tough wins. You know, Adam Scott winning the Masters 2 weeks ago, winning ugly, just grinding it out. So the Catholic life some days is about grinding it out, turning up, being there for the sacraments, and just turning up.
And you've mentioned, of course, your family all the way through this interview. What I suppose not the importance obviously can't be overstated, but how do they fit into to your work? I mean, the support that they provide for you, the stories, I suppose, you get a lot of the podcasts, blogs and whatnot.
Karen's,
I suppose, between life and work.
Yeah, and people email me about that because I talk about, you know, that I road ride, like I got a great sort of road bike and I ride a lot, and I golf's been a big thing for me. But you got to see that in the background of somebody who almost burned out. So golf isn't so much an indulgence as a kind of contemplative strategy for survival. That's what I tell Karen anyway. Now, the answer is, like, one thing we need to do, and a mate of mine who's the head of marriage and family in London, he sent me an email this morning about it. Like, we got to get back to a theology of marriage and family. Like, you know, we sort of think that marriage is about personal happiness. And, you know, St. Augustine kind of thought that parents were kind of like bishops in terms of the leadership and formation in the home. And this is a sacrament. What marriage does, at least in my experience, is marriage just exposes you all the time. It just nonstop, mirror up to your face. You will, you know, all your selfishness, all your garbage is just constantly on display, and it's this constant call to holiness. And Karen and I have been married 12 years on Sunday, and, you know, it's just this, you know, this constant desire to grow in holiness by slowly getting better at loving her and the kids. I got to say, it's really tough. Like, our kids, we had 3 kids under 3.5, and it's really tough. Like, to juggle what I juggle is really hard. And anyone that says it isn't is crazy. So, but, you know, they get a lot of us. They get us. They get to have us around all the time. Karen and I are both at home full time. And so that's cool. How do we juggle? How do we fit it in? You just do. You just come in. If you've got kids, Jamie, you just do. It's like when you jump off a diving board, that 10-meter platform, you don't have a lot of options. You just make it work. But look, I go to Reco, as I keep saying, because I just really want to encourage people to think about that sacrament. And sure. I'm now providing the Casey listeners, they can be my.
Oh, we dropped off for a bit there, Jonathan. Your Casey listeners, we missed after that, mate. I'm sorry.
I just was saying that for the listeners, you know, that I've talked a fair bit about reconciliation because I think it's so important. And I think a lot of time I'm in there just really aware of all the ways that I'm not loving these guys properly. And I don't know, Karen will die. She'll say it sounds like I'm terrible. I'm not. Like, I'm really good with them, but I could be better. And so, you know, just being with them and being attentive and being patient and all those sorts of things. So I don't know how well I answer that question, but we make it work.
I find confession is a bit it's putting out a litany of all your worst things, really, and you rattle it off, and it's a bit like, well, hang on, I'm not really this bad person. But it keeps you humble. It keeps you humble, well, doesn't it? It's sort of, when you bring all this to the fore, it realises how bad you can really be.
Oh, and look, and how countercultural is it? Like,
oh, indeed.
I there's an article on being Catholic that I wrote called Oprah and the Sacrament of Reconciliation, and Ranieri Cantalamessa, who was the preacher to the papal household for John Paul II, he's a Franciscan, his theory was that when the church drops a sacrament and stops practicing it, the need for the sacrament doesn't disappear. It emerges culturally in another form. And his take was, if you track Freud's psychoanalysis stuff right through to Oprah's couch and, you know, Helen DeGeneres' couch, they're places where celebrities come out and confess their sins and they disclose themselves. So we have a fundamental human need for self-disclosure to the right people, to be honest about the truth of what's really going on. So part of how I've survived is to have a group of good guys around me and a few, I've got spiritual directors and great priests. And I think for your Catholic listeners, like, if reconciliation's been a problem, the thing they've got to do is find the priest you can work with. You've got to find a priest that you really connect with who knows you and can be a real doctor of the soul. So, that's what I think about that.
Yep. Well, look, one last thing. Where can people find you if they want to get in touch with anything?
I'm just in my kitchen. Oh, you mean on the internet? All right, okay, sorry.
Or on the golf course.
Where do I start? Yeah, on the golf course. Find me at Royal Canberra, like, 5 days a week. Now, okay, basically, it depends what you use. If you're a Twitter user, my Catholic Twitter account is being Catholic one word. On Facebook, the easiest way to find me on Facebook is just FB Jonathan, JONATHAN.com. If you type FBJonathan.com, into a browser, then you'll end up on a Facebook page. But probably the Being Catholic site, which is simply beingcatholic.com.au, being Catholic, one word. So I'd love people to, you know, flip us an email through there if they've got any questions or anything they want to agree or disagree with. And and my motivation stuff, my weekly podcasts are on the jonathandoyle.co site. So that's jonathandoyle.co.
Anything on iTunes?
Yes. If they do a Jonathan Doyle search in iTunes, you'll find me in there too. I've got the Being Catholic interviews and podcasts are there. In fact, if you just did a Being Catholic one word search in iTunes, but if you did a Jonathan Doyle weekly podcast search in iTunes, you'd find me in there too. The weekly podcast is cool. I love doing that. It's a different sort of group, and people might really like that one too.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on, Jonathan, and congratulations for Sunday for 12 years marriage. It's fantastic.
Hey, thank you. I hope you bought me an expensive gift. I shall wait by the letterbox.
It's in the mail. I don't know whether it'll get there or not. You know, it's a bit shifty sometimes.
No worries, mate. Look, thanks for the interview. It's like, some of the interviews I do are just, you know, like, if they're commercial radio stuff, it's toxic and they're hard work. But this has been great. And just, mate, thank you for the work you're doing and making it possible.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. And hopefully we can have you again in another year or two and see how things have progressed. So thank you for your time.
Awesome. Thanks heaps, Jamie.